I'm Chase Cavanaugh with WUKY. With me today is Dr. Robert Farley, an assistant professor at the University of Kentucky who's written a new book about abolishing the Air Force. Dr. Farley, please tell us a little more about it.
Oh, well, the name of my book is called Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force, and it's coming out with the University Press of Kentucky in early March. And as the title would indicate, it is about folding the United States Air Force into its two constituent services, which would be the Army and the Navy, and then going down to a two-service model rather than a three-service.
What got you started along this research path?
Well, I became interested in inter-service conflict and the way that the services essentially fight and argue with one another. When I started reading a lot of the material associated with the end of the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, it was very interesting to me how especially the Army and the Air Force really degenerated into some nasty infighting about who was responsible for really defeating the Iraqis and bringing victory over Saddam Hussein. And that got me interested in the subject, and so I then began to follow up sort of the history of inter-service conflict with respect to air power. Essentially, this replays itself. This pattern replays itself after every major war and often during every major war, that there's always conflict between the three services, but that conflict seems to be particularly bitter when air power is involved.
Could you talk to us about an example of this today?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think one of the best examples actually comes out of Robert Gates' new book, or his autobiography, Duty, memoir, where he talks about how the Army and the Air Force squabbled over drone warfare during the wars on terror. The Air Force has never been particularly enthusiastic about drones. It can be overstated how hostile the Air Force has been to drones. They've certainly accepted the mission when it's been given to them. But some of the other services, the Army in particular, and also the intelligence community, were very interested in drones. But the Air Force, because drones, allowing drones to be under Army or CIA or other control, would violate their precept of centralized air control. The Air Force almost felt compelled to pursue control of drones. And so, as Robert Gates said, this was a capability that they weren't interested in, that they didn't particularly like, but they felt that they had to completely monopolize at the expense of the other services.
With all this inter-service conflict, how do we maintain a cohesive air command in the first place?
With every war, we have to develop a new set of relationships between the services and a new way of approaching air and ground cooperation. At the beginning of every war, you almost always find that there is a great deal of conflict over where responsibilities lie. There are often friendly fire incidents, as there were with the first Gulf War. There are often cases in which air support is not where it's supposed to be, as we had with Afghanistan. But it turns out that, you know, over the course of a war, those differences usually get smoothed out. Right? It's during peacetime, when the services are pursuing their own interests, that we start getting really serious conflicts that then manifest themselves at the beginning of each new war.
With it being peacetime right now, do you view that as an ideal time to pursue this new course of action?
Absolutely. I think that right now is a time where we can look ahead, and you can never be sure because it's the international system and things are a little bit random and chaotic. But right now is a time where we can look forward and say, we don't really foresee a major conflict in the next decade. We don't really foresee minor conflicts in the next decade. And so now is a good time for us to think seriously about reforming our military institutions for the decades ahead, right? Figuring out a better way of doing procurement and technological innovation and creating service doctrine. I think now is ideal for that.
What sort of criticism is there to your argument, and how would you address it?
Well, there's one critique that people make a lot, and it's really more of a question than a critique. It's, sure, this sounds okay, folding the Air Force into the Army and the Navy, but why not just go the whole way, right? Why are you so biased against the Air Force in particular when some other countries, Canada, for example, but China and Israel also operate on the model of having a unitary service? And my answer to that is that there are still benefits to be had from inter-service competition and inter-service conflict, and that in particular, having the Army and the Navy being able to compete over being able to provide security for the United States is a good thing to have, right? To have them be able to critique each other's procurement programs. And that also what the Army and the Navy do is still sufficiently distinct. It's not as distinct as it was in 1910, but it's still sufficiently distinct that the Army can plan out an operational campaign and the Navy can plan out an operational campaign without a great deal of input from one another. Air power permeates everything that the Army and Navy do, which means that essentially every time the Navy thinks about how to fight a war or the Army thinks about how to fight a war, it has to involve the Air Force. And that makes inter-service conflict particularly problematic when you involve air power.
How would you address the Air Force's claim of unique capabilities, such as strategic bombers, missiles, and more high-tech hardware?
I would respond on the one hand by saying that many of the capabilities we think are unique aren't actually unique, right? The Navy has what are, in effect, strategic bombing capabilities with its aircraft and with its cruise missiles. So that's part of the answer. The other part of the answer is that the Air Force has unique capabilities because we have given it unique capabilities. We have given it unique responsibility. For example, the Air Force has unique air transport capabilities because the Army is legally prohibited from flying fixed-wing transport aircraft. If you take that away, the Army will want transport aircraft and will buy transport aircraft. I think that's the same way with all of the other responsibilities, the cyber responsibilities, the space responsibilities, the drone responsibilities that the Air Force has. They have it. It's unique because we made it unique. We can change that.
Couldn't people also make the same argument, though, that if you gave those unique capabilities back to the other branches, would they necessarily be as efficient with it?
Well, it is really hard to evaluate the efficiency of different kinds of institutional arrangements. But I think one way that we can at least think through why do services particularly value certain kinds of capabilities is because they really need them, right? And I think, again, the Air Force is a useful way of looking at that, right? There are certain capabilities that the Air Force has uniquely, which it does not seem to value very much, right? And drones is one of these. Air transport is another one of these. The unique things that we are going to be shifting from the Air Force to the Navy and to the Army are things that the Army and the Navy really need, right? The Army and the Navy really need the ISR, the reconnaissance and surveillance, ask things that the Air Force does. The Army and the Navy really need aerial refueling. They really need cyber. They really need base communications. And so I think that actually, because they really need these and because we're tearing down bureaucratic walls that the service actually forms, that it's going to be more efficient than it is right now.
What sort of Air Force response has there been to your argument?
It's been a variety of different responses. The funniest one so far has been from the Air Force Chief General Mark Welch, who essentially said that we should shoot this argument in the head. And he said it while wearing a Captain America mask, which was just hilarious. I have that up on my wall. You know, broadly speaking, Air Force personnel have responded. They've responded with interest to the argument. They have generally responded with intellectual curiosity. They haven't been happy about the argument that I'm making, and they've certainly argued back in a lot of ways. They've argued again about the unique capabilities that the Air Force provides. They've argued that it would be difficult for the other services really to provide these, even if we folded in. But in general, it's been a constructive set of responses to the argument that I'm making.
Finally, on this subject, what sort of momentum has there been from the other branches of the military to reducing some of the Air Force's capability?
At this point, there's not a lot. The inter-service conflict in the United States has been essentially stymied since the 1960s, where the branches don't engage in a lot of direct conflict with one another. They don't engage in a lot of sort of above-board public criticism of the other ones because they don't want their own procurement priorities challenged by the other services. And so there hasn't been anything in the way of, say, an Army chief of staff publicly embracing the idea of eliminating the Air Force. I've talked to people in the Army. I've talked to people in the Navy. There's some curiosity. There's also some concern. Well, you know, are we really prepared to take on all of this that the Air Force does? But that's fine, right? It's part of the discussion, and it moves the conversation forward when we can have a discussion between people from the different services.
Moving on to a little more about your work in particular, you're part of a very small graduate school here on campus, the Patterson School of Diplomacy. Tell us a little bit about what you do there.
Well, it's the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. It's a bit of a mouthful, but we are a master's level program, a terminal master's program. We matriculate 35 students a year. The program is 18 months, and we produce students for government service, for non-governmental organizations, for journalistic endeavors, for corporations that are interested in the international sphere, and we place them all over. I mean, basically what we're trying to do is to educate students for international careers, whether that be in government, in defense, or anything else.
The Patterson School does a lot of educational visits to corporate headquarters, government offices, and even military bases. Has there been any issue with you not being welcome on any Air Force bases?
To be honest, no. I was actually invited down to the Air Command and Staff College at Maxwell Air Force Base. And this, I think, shows you how intellectually there is a great deal of intellectual ferment in the services, right? And they're not. I haven't been blackballed. Nobody has tried to exclude me from conversations. People are genuinely interested in this kind of argument. So I've visited there personally. We've also, as a school, visited Wright-Patt Air Force Base and also the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton. you know, we visited Army installations. I'm not sure what other Air Force installations we visited or we have on the schedule, but there hasn't been any indication that we're being excluded yet.
Glad to hear it. And what have your students made of this argument?
You know, that's an interesting question. I am currently teaching an air power course in the Patterson School, and we've actually not really talked about the book. I haven't assigned the book. They don't have to read it. They don't have to buy it. And we have mostly been talking about the future and the past of air power rather than specifically about whether air power deserves its own service. So I don't know exactly what they think about it. I hope they like it, but they don't have to in order to get an A.
No chance that some of that argument might have seeped into your lesson plans?
Air Force people have historically thought a great deal about the independence of the Air Force, right? It was a major concern in the interwar period. And so when you read any amount of air power theory, you're always going to talk about this stuff. And so that naturally has found its way into the conversation. And I think that that's one reason why this argument sort of resonates, perhaps in a bad way for the Air Force, because they still think about the viability and the independence of the service in a way that the Army and the Navy really don't.
Finally, now that you've published this major work, what are your future plans?
Well, it's not actually published yet. We still have a few more weeks. But, I and a writing partner are right now working on a book project on intellectual property and the military diffusion of intellectual property. It's a book that we hope will be titled Patents for Power, Military Diffusion and Intellectual Property. We don't have a publication date and we're still writing it, but that's the next major project. And then beyond that, I'm interested in anti-submarine warfare and some other things.
Sounds like a lot of interesting subjects.
I hope so.
Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Robert Farley, assistant professor at the University of Kentucky's Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce. His book is called Grounded, The Case for Abolishing the United States Air Force, and will be published imminently by University Press of Kentucky. For WUKY News, I'm Chase Cavanaugh.